Welcome to the Abbott & Abbott podcast, a podcast for people working in the real world of IT. Who's SysAdmin, working in the help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And this is episode 38. Now, did you know that 38 is the sum of the square of the first three prime numbers, if you've ever bothered to do that? It's also the atomic number of strontium. Now, if you remember from last week about the roulette table of 38, there are 38 numbers in American roulette table. Another thing about 38, it's 38 special. It's a Smith & Wesson gun, revolver, and it's also a rock band as well. There are 38 games for each team in the English Premier League. And 38 in binary is 100110. And the last very uninteresting fact about 38 is that when you spell it out, T-H-I-R-T-Y-E-I-G-H-T, it begins and ends with the same letter. That's not too interesting. But when you reverse the number, 83, and spell it out, that also begins and ends with the same letter. And it's the only two-digit integer that can do this. Mm. So, that's 38 out of the way. And it's also another episode of the Admin Admin podcast. So what's everyone been up to this week?
I've been doing quite a big domain migration and doing lots with PowerShell, so that's what I've been up to. We can go a bit more into that in a minute. What have you been up to, Andy, then, with your side of things?
Well, I haven't had too much very interesting on this week. We've got a couple of things to reference. I've been having a go of I installed this on an old Dell laptop. It's a really low-powered, I think it's a single-core Pentium processor with about one gig of memory in it. It was really, really slow even on with Windows XP on, so I thought I'd try a Linux distribution on it. So I've installed Slacko Puppy Linux on it, and I've been playing about with it for a couple of weeks. Just using it as a machine for browsing, really. Just to learn a bit more about it and get used to it. Hasn't been too bad so far. I tell you what, though, it runs an awful lot better than XP does on the same bit of hardware. And I was actually running I don't know what it's called. What's the Linux version of Task Manager? It's just showing you how much RAM's in use and things like that. And
I think that's top.
That could have been.
We were just talking about it, weren't we? Off air.
And it was. I had the operating system loaded, and of course it comes with Firefox on. And I had one of the I don't know if it's LibreOffice program open. And it was using 120 megabytes, I think, of the RAM out of the gigabyte that was available. So I'd say it's not the best computer in the world or the best fast machine in the world, but it runs much better on that Puppy Linux than it does on Windows XP. Speaking of which, I was listening to a Linux podcast this week. I can't remember which one it was. And I don't know if you've heard about this or listened to the same one, but they're talking about a Linux distribution that was designed to be more for 32-bit binary and therefore could run Windows applications on it. I can't remember what it was called, though. They were talking about it, and it was a bit of bit disappointing that they were saying. But I just wondered what you thought about that kind of thing, you know, having a Linux program, open source, free to use, but it still run your Windows applications on it. I think the version they were talking about was very unstable, and they said it was untested and unstable, so it didn't really work very well and kept crashing out and everything.
But I'm not sure if that was our friends at Linux Luddites. They did a show.
Yeah.
I think it's called React OS.
Okay.
I think I could be wrong about that. I was only half listening to the show, I have to admit.
It could have been that one, yeah. But what do you think about that? Because it's buggy and it's not working right and it's crashing a lot and everything. But if hypothetically it did work pretty good, what do you think about that? Would you think would it be popular, you know, amongst the masses?
Well, there is and has been for years something called Wine, which will run Windows binaries natively on Linux. And it doesn't sort of virtualize it or everything. It has a system in place whereby it can actually run binaries. And it's kind of, you know, it's been there for years. It's never been... it's never become popular enough to, or I suppose implemented well enough to, that it's just sort of click and play. So you
it,
often
it would have
to
be, wouldn't it? It would have to be, you know, for the uneducated, should we say.
Yeah.
Just for the normal person to be able to use and work.
Yeah.
It would have to be, you know, like Windows is now, I suppose.
Yeah. But, you often have to hack things around to get them working in Linux, and because the Linux is the design of it is so different, that can be a bit of a challenge sometimes. So.
Yeah, but I was thinking as well. I mean, think about years ago. How can I put it really? I mean, if I think back years ago, you know, antivirus programs you had to buy, whether people did or not was a different matter, but you had to buy. You know, Microsoft Office, everybody wanted to have, and you had to buy it. I know most people probably didn't buy it, but they probably had some crack copy of it or something. But nowadays, you know, there's plenty of free antivirus you can get on the internet. There's plenty of free different scanning tools and, you know, things like JRT and ADW Cleaner and things like that. And you could even replace, just for the home, you could even replace Microsoft Office with the likes of LibreOffice or OpenOffice.
Yeah, you know. Or to be honest, I mean, that's great for open source, you know, supporting open source and whatever, but just for ease of use, I think Google Docs is the way ahead, you know.
Yeah.
Because then you don't have to maintain, you know, so if you're setting up for your NAN or whatever, you know, you just say, go to this web page. They don't have to worry about saving it. I don't have to worry about where the files are saved and all the rest of it. I know it's a bit freedom-hating, but it works really well.
Yeah.
I mean, I recommend it. My daughter does her homework on it so that she never loses the files and stuff. So.
If you think about it, it's a way of... I don't suppose it's 100% safe, I suppose, but it's pretty good. It gets backed up because no doubt Google have to back it up in some form or other.
Yeah,
you know, it's backed up. It's like any kind of cloud-based facility, isn't it? You have to have the internet.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I think LibreOffice were working on like a server version where you can do the same sort of thing as Google Docs, but I haven't really heard much more about it. But to be honest, I think that's the way things are heading anyway. So I think that's probably where they should be focusing their research on. But
yeah. Because I thought, I mean, I was just thinking of my customers, of what a lot of them want. You know, a lot of them don't want to pay for all this expensive stuff. You know, they don't want to pay for antivirus. They don't want to pay for Office. They don't want to pay for Windows half the time. But if that kind of Windows Linux system, should we call it, sort of got going, you'd have free Office, free Windows, free antivirus. Well, you wouldn't need antivirus, I suppose, then, would you? You know. And but it'd have to work just for the layman, wouldn't it? It wouldn't be very good. If you had to do stuff to make it work or modify it or run patches, you know, just people aren't going to be bothered.
Yeah, that might be what people like us can do in the future, though. We just run these servers.
Yeah.
And provide the service. So you go, I'll just go to this URL. It's my kind of instance of Andy Office or whatever.
Yeah.
And you can do your documents. It's all saved, and you can output Word documents and stuff if you need to send them or whatever, or you can, you know, share them. I know it's a bit of a utopian ideal, but you never know. You might get there at some point.
Yeah, it was on the Next Light, our friends who you met. You actually met the man and the Og Camp.
That's right, yeah. Yes.
React OS. They're later. I haven't got to that episode yet. I'm so behind, about 40 hours behind on my podcast listening. I have no idea how I'm going to
catch. Getting further and further behind every episode, aren't you?
I know. There's no way I'm going to be able to catch. I just haven't got long enough commute any work. I'm so busy during the day, I can't listen to podcasts like I used to at work. So, how's it going with you, Jerry?
Not too bad. I've been sort of neck deep in stuff at my new job. I'm looking at putting Ansible into to manage the configuration there. Keen-eared listeners might recall I went over Ansible quite a few episodes ago now. Now the way that they currently do the configuration at work is using Debian packages, which to me is a bit inflexible, a bit difficult, and it's quite a learning curve for me, whereas I already know Ansible. So if I need to make a quick change, I can do it much more quickly and effectively in Ansible. Mm-hmm. But I mean, what I mentioned last time I talked about it is it's a push. The methodology is push, so you have your code sitting on the server, and then that server contacts the nodes and pushes the configuration via SSH, and that's how your nodes get configured. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but that's basically how it goes. Now, when the guy was handing over to me, one thing he drummed into me is the nodes. If you rebuild an instance, a node, it needs to come up already configured, and you can't really do that if you're pushing the configuration from a master server. There's always going to be some delay between when the node comes up and when it's configured. So I've been, over the last couple of weeks, I've been looking at a way of tackling this, really solving this problem. And it turns out there's a thing with Ansible. It's a script called Ansible Pull. And what this does is it will go, you can run it at boot time. You have to install Ansible, you know, just the package. And then you can run this Ansible pull, and it will go to and fetch from a Git repository, or I think you can use some other thing like FTP or SFTP or whatever, download the configuration onto the node and run Ansible to get that node configured. So this is the sort of thing that's challenging me at the moment. It looks like I might not be using that in as it stands now, because I was looking at putting a private key on the node and then contacting GitHub. Maybe I need to draw a diagram or go over this in more detail at a later date when it's all sorted, but the main idea was to get the code from GitHub, because that's where all our code sits at the moment, and then run Ansible on that to configure the node. But what it looks like I'm going to be doing now is sticking the code in an Amazon S3 bucket. S3 is the storage service, so it allows you to store data there. And what I will do is get the nodes to download the Ansible configuration from there at boot time.
Yep.
And just run Ansible locally to get the node configured. So the reason I want to do this, it's not just because I love Ansible. I do love Ansible, and it is my preferred way of configuring servers. But if I am configuring, if I'm just doing something on the fly, I'll do it in Ansible, and then that Ansible code will be there when, if and when the node gets rebuilt, the Ansible code will be run in exactly the same way as it was when I did it on the fly. And the other thing is the way the developers work, they use this use something called Vagrant, which basically wraps VirtualBox and allows you to bring up a virtual machine quickly and easily. We can reuse these Ansible configurations to get the exact same environment on the developer's virtual machine on the laptop as exists in the infrastructure in the cloud, in inverted commas. So that's my end goal anyway, but it's taking quite a while to get there, but I'm learning a lot as I go through it. So yeah, I've been playing with that, playing with Terraform a bit, which is the, I think I've talked about that, this sort of language which is being used to build the AWS stuff. And yeah, just learning more about AWS. So that's really it for me. Quite a lot. Doesn't sound like a lot now, but it's taken me quite a while to get my head around things. But it's all new stuff. It's all interesting. So that's good.
So I was saying that I've done the Office 365 migration for one of our customers. So they've got 130 users about, and they're all kind of on, all their email at the moment is POP3, so they've got a Linux server out there somewhere, and they're basically just downloading their mail directly onto their laptops or on their PCs. No calendar sharing, anything like that. And each of these PCs are just local work group PCs. Half of them are like home, premium, 7 machines. None of them are, half from a pro, there's no domain, so there's no way of like controlling these 130 machines. So they want to migrate, they want to have a domain so we can control their PCs and do interesting things like that, centralized database of username and passwords, and they want to get it off of 365 so they can do calendar sharing and things like OneDrive for business so they can share their documents. So it's quite interesting working out how I was going to get from 130 different people working to getting them to go to the solution of getting everyone working off of 365 and having them logged on, their PC logged onto a domain and accessing their emails. So what I was doing is I basically curated, I had to basically, first of all, create the users in my Active Directory. So you set up a, someone already set up an Active Directory for them, but no one was really using it. So it took a bit of time, but I finally got the customer to get their, a list of all the people's email addresses and what their username, what their first name and last name was. Okay. And then I put that into a CSV file. And so it had their first name, last name, and they also, funny enough, they, everybody had a different set of email addresses. So some people were like first initial, last name at the company name. Some was like first name, last name. Some was just like first name. So it's like a complete random way of how they set their email addresses up.
So they didn't have a standardized sort of, no, first name, last name, or first initial, last initial, or anything like,
no,
that.
Huh. So what I did was that in the spreadsheet, I put their name in and their first name, their last first name, last name, and what, and I basically written in Excel. I basically wrote like a PowerShell, like a command, like a, what do you call it? Like not PowerShell, but like a formula. So that it basically put their email address together. So it was first name dot last name at.
Is that a macro in Excel?
Yeah, I think the macro. I think macro is a thing you can automate, but a formula is something you can do to produce the output kind of thing.
Hmm.
So that, I did that.
A function, is it?
Function, maybe, yeah. and that basically formatted their email for them. And then in the next column, I basically put their alias of what their old email address was, so like whatever their email address was, so that when emails came into the system, it would still get delivered to their old one. When I sent a new one, it would go out from their default brand new email address. And also they had to be created to loaded groups as well. So I basically made a column for each group they needed to be to, and I basically said if anyone wanted to be in that column, they had to put yes in capitals in that box. And you know, so they're going to Office 365. So normally you can create using Office 365 manually, and then you can basically add the email address in what you want it to be. But as you remember, as I was talking a couple of weeks ago, that if you've had Exchange in your environment and then you basically sync your Exchange with Office 365, some do like the stage migration, or you do a hybrid configuration, you can't remove Exchange. That's because it puts attributes into the schema. So in Active Directory user computer, if you go into the properties of that user, you can see it's got a main email address in the box where you fill it out. But if you want to have an alias address, you have to put it in a proxy address in the Axel schema. Because this customer hasn't had an Exchange server in the past, you have to basically upgrade their schema so that it's got Exchange. So it's like you install Exchange, but you only do the schema part, which basically extends the Active Directory schema so that it puts these extra bits in so you can fill the information. Because normally if you had Exchange in sight, you could go into Exchange and add the attributes you wanted to. Because what we were doing is I didn't want to sit there and have to create 130 mailboxes in Office 365. So what you call a thing called Active Directory or Active Azure Active Directory Sync tool, which basically syncs whatever's in your Active Directory into Office 365, so that automatically creates the mailboxes into Office 365, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
What happens is that you have to have these values in the in this attribute. So you have to go into like ADC edit to put these in. And so I basically wrote this PowerShell script. I really like the idea of scripting. I've done so much scripting in the last 2 weeks of my life. I think I've So and it's just getting your head around it, yeah. And how you knowing what you do.
It's getting the computer to do stuff for you rather than doing it all yourself, isn't it?
Yeah, I wasn't going to sit there and create 130 user account. So using PowerShell, I used a command. I'm going to bring it up now. So I think it's called add-ad user. Okay. And that basically, if you do new-ad user, you can basically create the user account as you write new-ad user, and then you can put things like given name, surname, name, and it'll basically go along and create that user for you. So what's really interesting is that I must have stole this script from someone else, but what you can do is you can basically, once I put it into a spreadsheet, so you say that file's as a CSV file, and then you can basically, using the PowerShell command, you can import, using import-CSV, and then basically for every line, it's basically just like, it's like a loop, Jerry, so that you can say, yeah, every line of this thing, do this one thing.
Yeah.
So basically, I brought that in, and then you can basically put a variable, and you tell it what that line is. So you say, this column is equal to this variable, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So it sounds like a for loop to me. So for this variable in the list, do this thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to put the code in the show notes.
Yeah. So that's quite good. So basically, I do a load of things, like it tells you what it is. It also makes up the email addresses for you. And it basically like says new. Yeah. It's really good. So it basically creates that user. And then you basically, when I was telling you a bit, you have to add this proxy address, and you can't add that in at that value. You have to add it, you have to use another command to do that. So yeah, it's quite interesting. And then I was doing a bit where, like, it was quite odd because like some people had multiple email aliases, but some people didn't. So I had like four or five columns where there was nothing in there. So I used like, I was thinking it must be some sort of like regular expression where it's saying that if this value is empty, don't do it, if you know what I mean. So saying skip it kind of thing.
Okay.
So
how did, one thing I was going to ask about that is how did you test it? Because obviously you don't want to do it on a live database if you can't be sure that it works.
Well, luckily, because this is a clean install.
Okay.
It wasn't bad. But because I was doing as a new ad user, I was basically, you tell it to go into an OU. So like in Active Directory, you can basically create new users. And it goes in, and you basically normally create like the user OU. But I created a new thing called temp OU. And I was just running this script over and over again, because all I was doing is creating users. And if I mucked up, I could just delete the users, if you know what I mean.
Mm.
So it was nothing majorly that I could do wrong. So, yes, that's my PowerShell script. And once I've done that, obviously I had the 130 users in it. Also, I had to obviously assign them people email passwords as well. So that was a bit tricky. I didn't want to give people complicated random passwords because
people would just write them down and stick them on the post-it note.
So I basically just found out like an 8-letter word for them and put a capital letter at the start and put like an exclamation at the mark. So I basically just found like a word list online to do that with kind of thing. But I really should have checked that word list out first because there was some bit of inappropriate words in that 8-character word list, let's say.
I'm going to say I use some 4-letter words for some of mine. Well, 8 no. works as well.
Yeah.
With a capital.
Yeah, so I basically then created 130 users, it's fine. And I use this program called Active Directory. It used to be called DirSync, but it's actually called Active Directory, Active Azure AD Connect Server or something. I'll put a link in the show notes. But basically, that syncs your internal stuff, your internal AD to Office 365. So it populates everything for you. And it also does password sync, or password hashing. So whatever your local password is using on your computer, it will be the same because it hashes it up. And we've gone over that in the past. So that you don't have to have a different password for your Office 365 account. But annoyingly, it was annoying because there's an old thing called DirSync, which is really old. And it tells you to how to set it up. You go into your Office 365 account and click on download sync up your directory, but it doesn't download the latest version. It downloads like a really old version. But I recommend downloading this newer version because what the newer version is, you can basically do OU filtering. So you can say anyone in this OU filter out and basically upload to Office 365. You don't want basically random accounts. If you've got like for service account or test account, you don't want them uploading to Office 365 because it's a bit of a mess. What I did find is that with a new one, you can do by group. So I basically said, if you remember this Office 365 group, basically sync to the cloud. Also, so when you get into Office 365, the problem you've got then is that you have to assign a license to it. And what interesting it was is that I wasn't going to sit there and assign 130 manual licenses to these users. And I didn't realize, but you can actually connect to Office 365 via PowerShell. So normally you do all your configuration by Office 365, but you can basically connect your PowerShell to Office 365. And then from Office 365, you can then run your PowerShell. So I did another script where I assigned the licenses. So this is like another PowerShell command, which is interesting.
This is the power of the API, you see. It's like with AWS, you can click around in the in the web front end, just as you would with Office 365 maybe, or you can use something like Terraform, which talks to the API, but you can, you know, effectively write a program which talks to the API, which is where it becomes really powerful.
Yeah, because basically you just write three commands you have to run. You have to basically just tell it to assign the user what location it is, and then you have to just tell it to assign what license you want to it. And I didn't basically want to sit there and do 130, so I just basically wrote a code in about 20 minutes to do it. Mm. So I'm really impressed with myself. I'm kind of actually understanding how PowerShell and scripting kind of works now, especially when I've got the if and loops now and the kind of thing. It's just kind of getting my head around different things. Like, I've actually got another customer who's a university, and they've got like 4,000 people using Office 365, and they're basically just using it to give them a copy of Office. And I'm going to have to use the same command, but they want it so that depending on what email address they've got, so they have like a student email address, it'd be like @student.name of university, or if it's staff, it'll be @the university name. And they want to basically, when they, because obviously they have people leave and start all the time, they don't want to go in and do it manually. They want some sort of script so that depending on what email addresses they got, that gets signed automatically, signed a license. But because what you can do with PowerShell, because I'm guessing you can do it in the web interface, you can basically pull a list of users which aren't licensed yet. So I think in Linux you call it piping. So I'm hoping I can say pull this list of users and then pipe that list of users into my next PowerShell command. And then and then using regular expressions, look at this field, and then does that make sense?
Yeah. I'm not sure how PowerShell works in that respect, but yeah, it tends to be more with one thing. You do an operation on something, and then you pipe the output into another script or another command with Linux. So it's not like you pipe a whole load of data out. You pipe one bit of data at a time, but then you can loop that, so you do it multiple times. But I don't know how PowerShell works. It might be more powerful in that respect, because it's kind of built to do these operations, isn't it? These Active Directory type things and so on. So yeah, I mean, good luck with it though.
What's the closest? If you were to compare it to something like Basic or C++, is there any similarities to any of them, or what else is it close to?
I think it's close to Visual Basic. I think PowerShell you can write in two formats. I think it's either C++ or Visual Basic. Because the way I've looked at it is that there's two ways of like looking at people's code, how they've written like the if loops kind of thing. So like in my loop, in my example, I've got like if something open bracket equals the value name equals yes, and then I've got a little mustache kind of thing?
Curly bracket or brace or braces.
Yeah, I've then got that is like if then kind of thing. So I think there's different ways of.
I've got to say, this doesn't work too well on the radio, so you have to put it in the show notes. I came across this when I started on this podcast. It's like, I really want to explain this script to you, but I can't because it's radio.
Yeah.
Well, we've all got good faces for radio. So
oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
but yeah, I used to do, when I was, I did Higher National HNC in computers years ago. And one of the things I did for one of my main projects was, I was actually doing it in work when I worked for Unilever. I was creating I was using Access, but I was creating a database for a technical library whereby users could input data or search the data for whatever they were looking for. So I was using Visual Basic, which we call VBA. I think that's Visual Basic for Access. I don't think it's the same as proper Visual Basic, but it's very similar.
Yeah, that was all built into the Office stuff, wasn't it? So that you could do macros, talking about.
It was basically, So there'd be, you'd fill a load of forms out on the Access database, and then you'd hit a create button or whatever. But in that create button was the VBA script, you know. And it had to create a unique identifier number using the Dewey Decimal System. So, not like when you go to a library, all religious stuff starts with the number 900.
Yeah.
You know, all sports starts with 300, whatever. So we created our own, but I had to create these Visual Basic scripts to say, you know, the people had input the data and the script had to create a unique number based on what they'd put in there. And I thought it was getting quite good at the time. and I knew it inside out, but unfortunately that was on Access 97. So it's
one thing you can learn from that is SQL, which is a way of talking to databases, which is useful, you know, MySQL, Oracle, Microsoft SQL Server. They all use this slight variance on this language. I think it's structured query language. So, I mean, it's basically like select something from a database where something equals something. And you can kind of think of a database like an Excel spreadsheet, a little bit like an Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah, so. I do. I think of it as columns and rows.
Yeah, that's basically
columns,
what it is. Yeah,
and data entry is a row. You know, so you maybe want to search.
Yeah.
A column for.
Yeah.
I don't know, a value greater than.
Yeah, but then a database can have multiple tables in it, which is like a bit like worksheets in Excel, and
subtables and stuff like that.
Yeah. And then you can have multiple databases. Like a level above that, and then so you can join things from different databases together. And that's basically how modern web works. You know, you've got a web server, and then your data store is a database, and you look up and you write things into the database and get things out. And yeah.
So ironically, me learning all this VBA in Access 97, which is very scaly, nearly 20 years ago.
Yeah.
That's quite scary. But knowing that and sort of getting I've forgotten most of it now, but getting those basics in my head is still very relevant for today's world, in effect, because effectively a database is just a load of columns and rows, isn't it, whichever way you look at it.
Yeah. I mean, most web applications now use the database a bit like a file system sometimes, you know, to store data and get things out of data. And then there's different formats for exchanging that data between other apps or to APIs and so on. So, all still relevant. I mean, nothing changes really with computers, does it? And it's like we were saying about parity last week, wasn't it? We're it still exists.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, I'm sure my code could be a lot more tidier because I was like doing quite a lot of work where I was like repeating myself, and all I was doing is copying the lines, like I was saying, add to this group. But all I was doing is like copying that line as like an if statement for each one. So I think you could maybe be able to, is that called like a function or something? Maybe I could probably get rid of a function at the top to say, if you call this function with this value, run this kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I've got some Ansible code like that where I know I can make it simpler because loads of it's repeated all the way down.
Yeah.
But it's just, you have to refactor it. You have to go back and refactor it.
Yeah. So that's kind of thing. And that's obviously, so with the Office 365 migration, we basically said at the weekend, on a Friday night, we had basically changed the MX records, say, point from the old email server to the new email server. And on Monday morning, you access all your new emails through the Office 365 Outlook website so that everyone Outlook on the web. Because it was going to be really hard to get around and configure everyone's machines to speak to New Office 365 because there was no central management of the service to do it, which worked quite well. Hadn't had anyone complain yet they're missing an email, so that's quite good. But what we had to do for each of the machines is that we didn't want to log on to everyone's machine. So everyone's, not me, when I wrote the process of what you had to do, is that everyone's, you basically go to machine and you basically join their machine to the domain. But obviously they logged on with their new user account. They wouldn't get the same profile as they had before. So we used a program called ProfWiz. I don't know if anyone used that before, but basically it gives the permissions to the new user account to access their old profile, so that when they log on with their AD username and password, they get their old Windows profile. So it just looks, everything looks the same. And then when we logged on there, all we had to do was go into Office 365 and create a new Outlook profile, use Office 365, and then configure it to speak to Office 365. So then, and then we just had to basically get their PST file from their old system and then import it into Office 365. So it's been a kind of a tough couple of weeks trying to get this migration, getting all the information.
Sounds like you learned a lot in a short space of time.
Yes. Also, if anyone knows about that Google do a dig tool as well, you can to dig DNS details out. I know you can do it from the command line on a Linux box, but Google have got a website you can go to and you can put a domain name and it will just pull the information out of the domain for you.
All right. I did not know that.
All right. I didn't know that.
That's something new every day.
Yeah.
So, do you know the address for that, or can you search for it?
I think they say Google dig, and it comes to the first entry, what comes back.
We're all busily typing it now. If you're driving your car right now, please don't.
Yeah.
I had dig DNS lookup Google Apps toolbox. Yeah.
So I came to a couple of issues as well with that. This migration we're going to go through is that I had we found out that one of the sites had an SBS server on it, site we didn't know about. So these customers got free customers, and we found out that one of the sites had an SBS server. And as part of the migration we were doing the main site first and the second site. We're doing the second site this week. On Saturday, because one of their sites already on 192.168.0 domain and the other site was on 192.168.0 domain, they couldn't talk to each other if we put a VPN on because they're on the same subnet.
Ah, yes. We've talked about that before.
Yeah. So I basically went on Saturday morning to the site to change the IP address of the network, so it's on the new network. And everything went fine, except that this customer also had a second email address domain, which they haven't actually got access to the DNS to. So I'll go to that in a minute. But I was going, so when I changed the IP address on the server, it was absolutely fine. It's SBS box. The only thing that wouldn't work is that outgoing email would go absolutely fine. But if you replied to an email address, the mail wouldn't come in. So I spent a bit of time rebooting the server, stopping all Exchange servers and stuff. And then couldn't work out why mail wouldn't come on. So I basically did that good old MX Toolkit website. You can put the domain name in of what you're trying to test, and it basically said that it couldn't connect to port 25. So I basically used the good old netstat-a command that basically tells you what ports are open on that server. And 25 wasn't listening. So I thought, this is a bit odd. Googled it, and apparently, someone else came across it, is that in Exchange, the listening port, by default in SBS, it only listens to the primary IP address of the address it was first set up to. So it was set to 192.168.0.10, but it wasn't, the new IP address wasn't in there, so it wasn't bound into that IP address. So I basically just put it in there and said, bind to any IP addresses. Restarted the Exchange server, did netstat minus a again, and it was listening on port 25 again. So,
oh god,
yeah, that was interesting. And then today they were asking, they wanted to forward their email addresses from their existing email account to their new email address. So in Outlook, you can basically say any email we receive, redirect to your new account. So I did that, but the mail wasn't getting to Office 365. And then I guess you might have had this problem in the past, don't you? Where if you set off out of Office up or anything in old like SPS 2003, or SPS 2007, or Exchange, if you don't tick the box on the SMTP relay, what says don't let forwards arrive on the internet. So basically it's saying that don't forward emails out onto the internet. Someone puts an email address on the site. If you're new out of Office and someone emails you and you can reply to it, it basically, by default, it only reply to people in your organization. It won't send it out to the wider world. There's one little tick box you have to tick the box. And gets you out onto the internet.
So what was blocking that, did you say? What was blocking the 25?
Which part? Basically, Exchange tells in the SMTP relay, or the receive connector, sorry, it was bound only to the 192.168.0.10. And obviously, I changed the IP address of the server to 10. Dot whatever in your IP address range. And it wasn't binding it. So I basically told it to bind all IP addresses.
So
I'd have been looking in the router if that was doing that.
So did the server have two IP addresses then? One being 192.168 and one being 10.
That did have 19 address until I changed it to the new subnet so that we could reconfigure the network so that we could have a VPN back to the other office.
Oh, okay. So you could...
Oh, so you did a 2.1 on that or something, did you?
We went for different complete 10 class subnet.
Oh, right. The site. 10 DOS. Right, right.
Okay. So it only binds to local IP addresses, I guess.
Yeah, so it's binding to 192.168 by default, and I basically had to tell it to bind to the new IP address because it didn't know about Exchange. Wasn't clever enough to work out that I had a new IP address on there.
Okay. So it sounds like a bit of a bug in Exchange, basically.
Well, I don't know if it's a bug or not. I don't just think that I changed the IP address, and yeah, kind of thing. So,
okay.
So that's my fun week I've had, and I've still got another 2 weeks left because I've got two more sites left to do. Well, not too much for me because I haven't got to do much for it now because someone else is going to have to go around all the 130 computers and join into the domain, which is quite good. But half of them are XP homes or 7 homes, so we're not doing those. So.
Yeah. So you can't script joining them to the domain then?
You can do, which is a little ProfWiz program does it for you.
Oh, okay.
But because it's not on the domain already and the computers just seem to have random user accounts and passwords on, there's nothing you can do because it's not on the domain to do it. Bit of a chicken and egg situation.
Yeah.
Yes, so that's my fun week over and done with. So, do we want to talk quickly about? We talked last week. We were talking about raids, weren't we?
Yeah.
And we didn't get talking on about. This is probably going to be hard to explain as well without everyone seeing a photo of it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. We could do it like a series, you know, like a recurring series. Like each episode, we do a different raid level. So this week it's raid 10 or raid 1+0.
Yeah.
Take it away, Al.
Which basically means that you have to have a minimum of 4 disks. and the kind of the raid one confirms is a low amount of disks. So what you got is you have to think about it. You've got 4 disks and 2 of those disks are in one pair and the 2 of the other disks are in another pair. Those 2 disks, pairs of disks, they are set up in a RAID 1, which is basically mirroring. So you have, if you've got 4 disks, you've got drive 1 and drive 2, and they're basically making a mirror, and then drive 3 and drive 4 are a mirror as well. And what you then is you on top of that you do striping. So striping is where you that thing where you can read you can write and read really fast. So if you're doing it, so you've got if your first bit of data was basically block one will be written on disk one and two, and then block two is written on three and four, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. There'll be a diagram in the show notes, so
yeah.
Listeners so can follow along.
So basically it says, is it possible to combine the advantages and disadvantages of RAID zeros and RAID one into one single system? In RAID one, all data is written to one disk and mirrored to its counterpart in the pair. RAID 10 takes this one step further by striping this data blocks across multiple mirrored pairs. As in such, a RAID 10 set can tolerate the loss of multiple disks as long as one disk in each pair remains functional. If two disks in the same mirror pair failed at the same time, then the whole RAID 10 group is compromised and the disk is lost. RAID 10 affords excellent performance. It's considered more suitable for intensive IO application. The negative in using RAID 10 is that due to mirroring, only 50% of the total RAID capacity of the drivers available as usable space. So you're basically using quite a lot of your space, aren't you?
Yeah. You lose 50% of your raw space. So.
Yeah. And again, you can have the last one we can talk about is net RAID is RAID 50, where you're doing the same thing. But instead of having two disks doing RAID 1, you have it's doing the RAID 5 set. So the standard is RAID 0 stripes across multiple RAID 5 sets.
So if you compared RAID 10 to RAID 1 and you compare RAID 50 to RAID 5, what are the advantages of both of them compared to their predecessor?
You get more space out of RAID 50 because you're only with RAID 5 you're only losing one disk. So if you stripe a RAID 5, so if you think of it, if say you've got like six disks, one of those is a parity disk, and so you've got your five disks. So say each disk is a terabyte, you've got 5 terabytes there. So then think of those six disks and then put another six disks below them. And then that's you stripe those two, so you get 12 terabytes. But you can lose out of each of those six disks sets, you can lose one of those disks, and you still keep all your data, and you get the speed of having those six disks in a RAID 0. So which means it's really fast. So
does that help with the the write speed of which is the one that has a slow write speed? Is it RAID 1?
I think that's RAID 1, yeah, because you've got to write to both disks. So
it has a quick access speed but a slow write speed. Does that help? Does RAID 10 help with the write speed?
Probably not, because you've got to write to two disks. You've got to write one block of data to two disks still.
Okay. So what's the advantages over 10 over 1?
I don't really see that many advantages, to be honest. I don't know if Al can think of any.
I just think it means that you just get the problem you get is that the way when you get bigger and bigger discs, you get a problem. Not so with RAID 10, but with RAID 5, when you get more and more discs, it just causes that issue where you get the bit loss thing, or bit flip, where you lose something.
Yeah.
And the more and more discs you get in your things, if you have 10 discs in a single RAID 5 set, you've got so much data. If you lose a disc, a single disc, you've mucked up. You've got to take so long to reboot it. Where if you have in your RAID 50 set, you can split that down so that it's just a neat, better way of doing it, kind of thing.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, like I was saying, my old job, they used to have RAID 5 or RAID 6 hardware RAID, and then they used to do software RAID over the top of that, RAID 0, which means that you get a better speed out of it. I don't know if that counts as RAID 50 or RAID 60, because it's mixing hardware RAID and software RAID, but... Yeah,
I've got an interesting document I found on the internet about it from Promise, which is a kind of RAID controller, mate, and it kind of explains it really well, kind of thing. So I'll put that link in the show notes. So that's quick. One thing I do want to do is that kind of get, if our listeners could maybe try and get our podcast out there a bit more. I wanted to kind of get more exposure for our podcast. So I was going to ask our listeners if they don't mind trying to share our podcast out there with their fellow IT people. I'm going to get, trying to get more and more listeners out there if possible, so we can get some more feedback kind of thing. So that'd be good. Cause, yeah.
I'll recommend the Facebook group, or do a tweet of the web address or something, or anything like that.
Yeah, I think we need to...
free to do.
Maybe need to develop our social media outlets a bit.
Cool. Anyone else anything to say?
I just want to heads up. I mean, if you listen to Security Now or Geek News Radio, you might have heard of The Expanse, which is a sci-fi series. I think it's available. It's only available on the USA Sci-Fi Network at the moment. But obviously, you know, you can get a hold of it if you need to. And I recommend that you do, because if you like sci-fi anyway, because it's a sort of new series set in the sort of near future, when humanity's in space and just flying around space and stuff. And it's done really well, so I recommend it.
Sounds like Star Trek.
Yeah, except it hasn't got artificial gravity. They haven't got artificial gravity.
All right.
It doesn't mean it's all in zero G. There's a bit of a cheat, because they have magnetic boots, which allows them to not have to spend so much on special effects, basically. but yes, good storyline. It's a good kind of near future world, or universe, whatever you want to call it. Yeah, it's really good. And I'm reading a book as well at the moment, which is also pretty good.
Well, I had a failed job this week, which is actually a job that I couldn't do. And I kind of felt quite bad in a way, and I thought, my God, it's a job that I can't actually do. And what the problem was, I mean, I've done this loads of times before. I was doing a repair on a power jack on a Samsung laptop, quite a nice laptop actually. And the power jack had basically broke to pieces inside the laptop casing. So the guy only lives up the road from me. He gave me the laptop. He said, "Can you do power jacks?" I said, "Yeah, I can do them. I've done several before." He actually ordered the replacement power jack off the internet, and it cost a couple of pounds. It wasn't that much. And it arrived, and he gave me this power jack. I said, "Hey, could you solder this one on and unsolder the other one?" He said, "Yeah, no problem." Well, I got it back. I managed to strip down the... It was one of these, actually. Once I took the case off the bottom of the laptop, there it was right in front of me. I only had to take the bottom case off. It was dead easy to get to. But then that's where the problem starts. And this is the bit I failed on. I mean, I've never done this before, but I could not desolder the power jack at all. I was trying different... I mean, I don't have big equipment for doing soldering here. I used to do it in work years ago, but I don't have really good equipment to do it with. Temperature control, soldering irons or anything like that. I've only got sort of basic stuff. But even so, just desoldering a power jack doesn't take that much of a soldering iron to do. It's just pretty basic stuff. But I could not get this solder to melt. And when it did melt, I couldn't get it off the pins. I was working at it for a couple of hours over a couple of nights and just couldn't get this thing desoldered. I thought, this is unbelievable. I don't see how I can't do this. I gave him a call and told him what it was. And luckily, he works at Airbus at Broughton by us. So he said, well... He knows a couple of people that work in electronics. He said, could I take it into them and see see if they can do it for me. I said, yeah. I said, I'm not getting anywhere. I said, we're going to need some, you know, pretty good soldering equipment to get this lot off. And so I took it back to him. He took it into work, see this guy. And these people are soldering and desoldering all day, every day. I thought, right, they can do it. I cannot get this plug off or this socket off. I'm wondering what I'm doing wrong because this is stupid. How on earth can you not desolder something? Anyway, I took it back to him, left him to it. I got a phone call a couple of days later, and he said, and this is off the guy. He said, I took it into those people in work who are professionals at it. He said, they cannot take this power jack off. They can't do it. They can't get it to desolder. They can't get it. They were trying solder suckers. They were trying all sorts. They couldn't get it to come off. And actually, that made me feel a little bit better.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't do it, but these people couldn't do it either. So he phoned me up. He said, what are we going to do now? So I suggested a few things. If, you know, we may have to get a new motherboard. I looked it up as well. It's an RF711 Samsung laptop. And I looked up new motherboards, and they were £270 each, which he wasn't going to do. Anyway, to cut a long story, if you search YouTube, we found a YouTube video of somebody trying to take one of these sockets off on the video, and we did notice that he was having a lot of trouble as well. So we give this electronics engineer permission to be a bit more forceful with it, should we say, because I think he was trying to take it off really gently, you know, and easily and that. So we give him the permission to give it forcefully. Anyway, I've got it back, and apparently he was soldering and he was pulling on it with pliers and all sorts of stuff, and he eventually got it off with a lot of brute force. And then resoldered this new jack socket on. And when I got it back today, I had to put it all back together again, and it worked straight away. So it looks really good. It's a really, really neat job at the end of the day. But just in case anybody's doing power jacks out there, power jacks can be quite easy. Generally, they are quite easy to desolder and whatever. But sometimes, I don't know what was going on with this one. It was an absolute nightmare. But it's all done in the end. And he's just pleased, because if that hadn't have worked, what was his options? You know, new motherboard, new laptop, you know, all because of a part that cost £1 had broke. So I'm giving him back now, so he's happy.
It's just lucky you had an Airbus factory nearby.
Yeah.
That's the moral of that story.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when I worked at Leavers, they had all the gear as well. I could have done it in there if I still work there, but I've only got basic soldering equipment at home, so but yeah, these were down at just by Chester. There's an Airbus factory at Chester. They build the wings. They do the wings for all of them.
Yeah.
Most of them come off on the... Have you ever seen the... I think it's called the Beluga plane.
Yeah, yeah.
It's got a big bulbous front. The front opens up and they put wings in it.
Yeah.
They come in and out of Broughton nearly every day.
Yeah, yeah.
And they even make the 380 wings there as well.
Yeah.
But that wing, funnily enough, is too big to go on a plane. So there's an actual road that they had to build from the factory down to the River Dee. And they take the wings down on a truck down to the River Dee. It's then loaded on a barge, because the River Dee at that point is quite narrow, so it's like a flat-bottom barge. They take it up the River Dee on a barge, and they go up to Moston Dock, I think it is, up in North Wales. And then it goes on the back of a bigger boat, and then that sails round the coast to the north of France, I think it is. And then it goes on another truck, where they take it to, I think they're all assembled in France, aren't they, those planes?
Yeah, I think
all
so.
All the parts are made in different parts around Europe, you know, fuselage wings and all that.
Yeah.
And then they all go to one place to be put together.
Yeah.
So, so yeah. So otherwise, that's all. That's all from me. Where are we up to in terms of time? No, we're getting on a bit.
Yeah, I was going to say the same sort of thing happened to me the other day. Not like it's about feeling you can't fix something. We had a customer phone up saying, "Can you come and have a look at a problem for us? Because we're at our wit's end." And basically, they had an IT guy for his company, and they then left. And they just have some normal guy who does, and someone internally does their IT. He's not their IT, the full job. So they're basically just like a pay per hour kind of customer. So they aren't the contract customer. And it was basically that what was happening is that they had one site and they got two remote sites, and they could get traffic from one site to the other site, so they could go one way, but the traffic wasn't coming back. And they had a third party who looked after the routers, those ASAs, but I had no visibility at them because they're completely managed. And the guy was at the wit's end with the people who provided this networking equipment, the firewall, saying that it wasn't their fault. So they got me in to have a look, and it was definitely something wrong with the firewalls. But the guy was on the other saying, "No, it's not. And I basically just I could confirm that I could get traffic one way, but I couldn't get traffic the other way. And I was like talking back to one of the guys in the office saying, "Look, I'm right, aren't I? I'm doing this right. I'm not going mad that I can see traffic going one way, but I can't see traffic going the other way." And they said, "It must be something on the firewall." So on the ASA, you can do a thing called a traffic, I think it's called like traffic packets analyze or something. And you can basically tell it where the traffic is from one network to another. You say, like, "I want this IP address, this IP address, what ports you've got to reopen." It'll basically tell you if that port's open. And I was having like a guy at the guy and saying, "Look, I can ping the router, but I can't get past the router. It must be something on your router." And he run this task on the remote router, and then said the traffic could pass. And he said, "Look, it's let me pass the puppy." I was saying, "I know. But all that's telling you is that the traffic is allowed to leave that remote router. It didn't tell you that it can get to the other end." So I said, "Run that command, this GUI thing on the other end," and he goes, "And tell me what if it comes in." So I put the remote IP address, the thing in, and it failed. And he goes, he was like quiet for 10 minutes, going, "Let me have a look at this." And then they went away for 24 hours and then came back saying, "Yeah, there's a problem on the router. It should be working now," kind of thing. But I was going mad, like, I know that. You don't know the network, and you know that it should be working, but it doesn't work, kind of thing. So,
I did have a similar thing many, many years ago. I didn't know much about networking, but I knew that I could ping this and I could ping that. And I think it was exacerbated by the fact that we couldn't ping out because of our router, so we couldn't do ping tests and things. Yeah. And it turned out it was a problem on the other end's firewall. Was why we couldn't get in. So, and this guy was adamant that it was something on our end. And then he phoned back, like half an hour later, going, I'm really sorry, it was something on our firewall." Just goes to show, as long as you eliminated everything, then, it must be the other end.
Whatever remains must be the truth.
Cool then, people. We better. It's quite late now, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we're recording on the Monday night.
Yeah.
No, we normally record on a Friday night. I've got to be up early. I'm guessing that Jade's got to be up early. He'll go to London in the morning.
Yeah. As usual.
All right then, people. We'll do next episode. I think we'll do on SPF records, aren't we?
Yeah.
I can do some research to make sure I'm up to date. Is it DKIM?
Yeah, SPF and DKIM. Yeah. Do some email stuff.
Yeah, you can do the DKIM stuff there.
Yeah, no probes.
I'll do the SPF stuff. All right, then we'll speak to you all soon then.
Okay, see you soon.
Bye.